That's right. They learn all those things. Well, with you. Thank you so much for doing the show, and the best of luck with the rest of your research. We'll have to hear how this develops.
Thank you very much, and thanks again for having me.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Tomorrow, from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast, just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. What's going on? What are you still working on? Tanya don't ask Gigon, then on Zewa Dahun Sadache, Ungahuan, and Hadiwanodans, then the Aboriginal voices, Oscar Dewanyawa Oscopsi.
It is 6 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRC 101.9 FM. We're happy to have you along here at University of Kingston, Ontario. And you could catch us at www.ca and go to the listen button. Oh, my goodness. Sean, how are you?
Oh, I'm all right, Doug. How are you?
Now, I was just thinking, too, about the summertime, and we've been doing all these things all July and now into August, and people are commenting on it, which was fun.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, fun to get these
positive
comments. Oh, all positive. Yeah.
As I do.
No, probably not, because I'm trying to keep it all positive this year.
All right.
Outdoors, but
well, go ahead, Doug. Try and keep it positive.
We have it. We in Eastern Ontario with huge waterfalls, but the people in the Niagara area are being weeks now, and I was north a week ago and checked out what was happening, and there the forests there are wet still. They're good shape, so and all of the growth that comes in the the midsummer, it's all been good, and the streams in most places are still a little bit higher than I had expected for this time of the year, although mm-hmm. some of the lakes have been drained down. So I'm not quite sure what's going on. Maybe they're pumping the water out further north. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, to have just a couple of things set up. First of all, I've got one we're going to talk about. It was recommended to me, and I pulled up a bio on Melissa Powers. I'll talk about that. And you might have one or two items for the top of the hour. And
probably not, Doug.
And we're going to have a couple of guests drop by.
We've got guests.
I've got a few. So, yeah, it's going to be fun. Also, last week we started with the our youth, whoever you are and whatever age you are right now. And when I told them about what we're doing in a small group last week, and two of the early teenage said, yeah, well, wait a sec, can we do that? A 14-year-old session this weekend, and their favorite protest song and what it means to them. Mm. You sparked them. I played it for them, and off the and they played yours, and then that sparked one of them to say, hey, I've got one that you guys mm-hmm. might like. I won't.
I'm not going to say.
No, not yet. I'm going to let the listeners think about it, too.
I had to tell
your
little story last week and then tell us, but you never really said. So.
About yours?
No, never mind, Doug. Just move on.
Okay. An Oneida scholar, and she works at an interpreter as an instructor in his knowledge. And I didn't get exactly where she's working, but her work focuses on the original people, the Haudenosaunee, and their resilience within a contemporary Western system from the Oneida area. Maybe she's down in Western Ontario, like London or Windsor or mm-hmm. one of those places. Pretty anyway, cool. She wrote a book, Haudenosaunee Experience, and it was published.
The Haudenosaunee Experience?
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you want to hear what it's a little bit about? Not much.
Looking it up, Doug.
Oh, okay.
Probably not much.
Right? No. It's what's the title? O-N-K, W-E-H-O-N-W-E. The Ongwe. Is that right?
Ongwe.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So hey, you're reading it wrong, Doug.
I am sorry, but that's why you're here. You're Bert here. Anyway, her book serves as an essential guide to understanding the complexities of Indigenous identity within social work and modern policy, and it bridges the gap between traditional Haudenosaunee of the current social political landscape. That is in light of what we talked about 2 weeks ago. You know, the number of people who were trying to portray themselves as Indigenous. Remember that? So this book...
Ran into several.
Literally ran into them, or you just know?
No comment.
Okay. anyway, it's interesting.
Who wrote it? Susan M. Hill? Is that what you...
No. Day. Paulus is P-O-W-L-E-S-S.
Yeah, I got that.
Okay. Do you have any information? How much is the book, you know?
No. I'm sure it's in the one that you got.
Nope. No, I don't have any information about the cost of the book. Self-published, so... Get through the Scholars Press.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's... If you have any more information, that would be great.
Well, did you read the book?
No. This has just been recommended to me by to look up the name again. Hillary.
Hillary who?
That was the lady who talked to me. Hillary. Just last week. Yeah, based on what we talked about.
I don't even see the book, Doug.
No.
A Bow Forged from Ash. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have to go back. Well, it was Scholars Press. Put up for you now, I guess. Show a little bit of reading.
I don't know. I'm looking her up, and that's the only book I see.
Okay. I will try to. I know that
maybe that person had it wrong, just making stuff up.
Well, in that case, I'll get back because I know her and I met her dad before, so I'll call him and ask.
Whose dad did you meet?
Hillary's dad.
So,
I met this person before, and this is his daughter. Was at university and thinking about this idea, and heard our talk about being people who were involved in trying to portray themselves as something that they are not.
Well,
okay, and suggested we looked at that.
Seems odd that it's a whole entire book, but
published it could be small. It's like a lot of university students publish their work in different ways, and maybe that's what it is. I will find out for you for next week. Okay? Do you have another idea that you could recommend that we won't play it now unless you have
to... Another protest song?
Yes.
I knew you'd ask, but I can't think of anything
oh,
right
no.
now.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
I would think, though it's... What? And no longer, I guess, an Indigenous artist.
Not necessarily.
No, not necessarily. No. Okay, 99 Left Balloons. It's a German protest song of the 1980s. And it was...
Nina?
Nina sang it. Nina, N-I-N-A. Mm-hmm. In one word, she sang it. And it was kind of the war, because it was the Cold War between the Soviet Union, Russia, Soviet Union, USSR.
Yeah, at that time it was USSR,
and,
yeah.
So she wrote this song, which I assume was a protest song, in of that the balloons were, at least in my mind, were the... the missiles that could be sent.
Okay.
The balloons, 99 red balloons, yada yada.
Are they left like L-E-F-T or?
What? Left. I think it's luft, L-U-F-T.
L-U-F-T. Oh, yeah.
You don't even know.
I bet you I
listen to the radio in the 80s, Doug?
80s. Oh, that was so far away.
No, it's not. It's not that far.
No, that's okay. We'll play it. We'll play it for people. This is song and the memories that go with it.
Hey.
Yep.
Listen. Luft balloons is one word.
Got it.
Find the lyrics for you because, you know, you're all about the lyrics. I'm all about the lyrics. I listen to them, don't know what they say. So I look up the lyrics. And it's in French, so German. It's okay. In German, so yeah. I don't know what they
are. So you're in trouble. We're going to play her song.
Yeah, they're both good. She did an English version as well, and they're both very good. But initially, the German song was...
So you want to play both, like one after the other?
Original. I don't care, sure. You have to find...
Search for it for you out of our archives here.
Oh, you know what? I think 99 Red Balloons was the English version. So okay. I'll look up that.
99 Red Balloons.
And Nina was N-I-N-A.
Yeah, N-E-N-A. Okay. And the last name?
That's it. That's it. She was just...
Just Nina. Okay. Good.
You and I in a little toy shop buy a bag of balloons with the money we've got, set them free at the break of dawn till one by one they were gone. So that's the initial. And honestly, the English is you know, for us that are not German speaking, but the German one is the one to listen to first.
Okay. I will do that for you. When you think about it, the Cold War caused this big split in Europe so that people who used to live in Germany were in East Germany, and then the West Germans were on the west side of the...
Yeah, it wasn't that, much longer. I think, 86, 87, 88,
89.
There.
Yeah, 89.
Well, they started work. was it Ronald Reagan had started to...
Mr. Gorbachev, tear this wall down.
Yeah. They were talking about all of that. So it was a tense period, the wall going up, and everybody showed up and help tear it down, and it was the end of this in Germany.
Okay, 99 Luft Balloons first. Here goes. Yeah.
Sowas kommt. an keinem Platz ist, da gibt's nicht mehr. Und auf keine Düsenflieger, heute zieh ich mal die Welt in Trümmern liegen, hab einen Luftballon gefunden, denk an dich und lass ihn. You and I in a little toy shop, buy a bag of balloons with the money we've got, set them free at the break of dawn, they were gone. Back at base, boxing the software, flash the message, something's out there, floating in the summer sky, 99.
We're tackling something pretty heavy, actually. We're looking at the history of food in Canada, but specifically how Indigenous food systems and sovereignty really became, well, a target for colonial policies.
Yeah.
It's more than just food.
Yeah, sometimes as a weapon. That's the absolutely crucial finding, I think, from all this material. Indigenous food systems, it wasn't just some unfortunate side effect of colonization.
Right.
The sources are clear. An intentional strategy, really a function of colonialism, designed basically to assimilate people, break their economies, and maybe most importantly, sever that deep spiritual.
Today is kind of twofold. First, we want to unpack that historical blueprint, you know, the laws, the economic moves, the culture. Second, we really need to get into the powerful communities are, you know, literally growing their way back to sovereignty. It's pretty inspiring, actually.
It really is. But to understand the history, we should probably start with the press role. Let's look at the story of Mark Bell. He's a band counselor at Erlen First Nation in Nakina, Ontario. Just the challenges he faces feeding his family today really...
...own trip to the grocery store. For Mark Bell, his local northern store closed down. So now, you know, basic stuff means a huge trek.
Huge. It's to the nearest supermarket. That's a no-frills in Geraldton.
Wow. 131 kilometers.
Yeah, the time alone just to shop, that kind of statistic, it just stops you in your tracks.
It really does. And it makes traditional hunting seem less like just a cultural practice and more like...
Yeah. Well, despite the costs involved in hunting itself, the sources really highlight the value of traditional food. Like one successful moose hunt, that yields 486 pounds of meat.
486 pounds.
Yeah. For Abel's family, him, his wife, daughter, father, brother, sister-in-law, that's enough food for six people.
But what about the cost? You mentioned costs.
Yeah.
What did the sources say about the financial Mark Bell doing this hunting, the driving?
Well, it's pretty staggering when you break it down. Bell figured he spent at least $2,700 just on the expenses during the last moose season. Processing the meat, replacing gear. And that's not even counting the big upfront costs. You need a heavy-duty truck, you need a quad, just to get through.
Right. So traditional food is the best option, the most efficient in some ways.
Yes.
But getting it needs this expensive infrastructure, this knowledge, and that's all under threat.
Precisely. And that modern economic pressure, that chokehold, it leads us right back to those historical roots you mentioned. The decimation by design.
Okay, so who's in it?
Oh, it was comprehensive. Charters, things yeah. like the Gradual Civilization Act, direct bans on crucial ceremonies like the potlatch, and treaties. Treaties that sounds essential for survival, for tiny bits of farmland, and frankly, pitiful amounts of cash. They were trying to force a European farming model onto people whose entire way of life was based on immobility and the land.
It's interesting, though, you mentioned earlier sources showing indigenous food knowledge.
Yeah, there was that early period. People like Catherine Partrail wrote about settlers learning to thrive on wild rice, maple syrup, things like that. An exchange happened.
Yet it was unequal. And didn't last.
Definitely unequal, and it turned predatory really fast. A perfect example. Pemmican was incredibly valuable. It's this traditional mix, powdered meat, grease, berries. Super high protein, shelf stable, essential for the fur trade, especially those long trips.
Okay, so how did this vital food become a tool of control?
Monopoly power, basically. When the Hudson's Bay Company got its monopoly in 1821, they saw an opportunity. They systematically started driving pure economics for them.
Ah, so the indigenous producers got less money for the same amount of pemmican.
Exactly. Income they needed for trade goods, for survival, they had to produce.
Okay, I see. They were caught in a bind.
Totally. And that pressure, that forced increase in production, the near elimination of the plains bison, as one source puts it.
Right, because bison was the key ingredient.
The key ingredient. So once the bison herds collapsed, the plains people, who depended on them for everything, suddenly became reliant on the government for famine relief. It was an economic knockout blow, kind of disguised.
Two is thinking about the timing. Globally, this is the period, 18th to mid-20th century, when food is being revolutionized everywhere else, right? Canning, refrigeration, mass production.
Exactly. While all that modernization is happening elsewhere, Canadian policy was intensely indigenous culture, including their food practices.
So they were actively excluded.
Excluded. And the result. Communities became dependent on expensive US government rations. It created a dependency that we're still dealing with today.
Which brings us right up to the present day crisis and maybe some of the failures of more recent government attempts to fix things. The stats on food insecurity, just not having access to affordable, healthy food, they're shocking when you compare.
They're horrifying, especially in the North. One study found 70%, 7-0, of Fort Albany First Nation in Northern Ontario was food insecure.
70%.
Yeah. And get this. Residents there would need to spend 56% of a healthy diet. We're not talking about fancy stuff. We're talking basic nutrition.
And the big federal program meant to help, Nutrition North, was supposed to use subsidies to make food cheaper up north.
But we've all seen those photos online, right?
Yeah.
Like $28 for a kilo of grapes.
Right.
The intention might have seemed okay, but the execution, the core logic, was flawed. Joseph LeBlanc, an expert from Wukwemkum unceded territory, he puts it brilliantly. He calls Nutrition North a failed, market-based, non-Indigenous solution.
Why non-Indigenous? Why does he say it uses the wrong lens?
Because it just doubled down the market system in the North. Its whole focus was making store-bought food cheaper. It assumed that the standard Western diet was the only goal.
Ah, so it didn't even consider strengthening local traditional food system.
Exactly. LeBlanc says it uses the wrong lens because it completely ignores that possibility. It just subsidizes the very same place.
That point about the standard diet assumption, it's echoed by a dietitian in the sources, Terry Morrow. She says assuming everyone needs the same Canadian diet is basically colonial thinking.
Right. Someone hunting seal up north doesn't have the same nutritional needs or resources as someone in downtown Toronto. It seems obvious, but traditional diets, roots, tubers, lichen even, way up north, they meet different needs. The solutions are often already there, refined over centuries.
Morrow gives a great example with the Oneida Nation's flint corn. It's like traditional food science.
Yes. It's all in how they prepare it. Traditionally, they cook the corn with lye or hardwood ash. That chemical process makes the calcium and iron in the corn way more available to the body.
So it's not just corn, it's enhanced corn.
Exactly. That traditional cornbread, maybe combined with some nuts and berries, provides protein, vitamins A, C, fiber, like dairy, which wasn't traditional. The answer isn't necessarily cheaper milk shipped from the South. It's reviving that traditional, highly sophisticated food preparation.
But even with that knowledge, communities run into huge roadblocks trying to restore things, especially commercially. Like the rules around...
Massive one. It's such a paradox, isn't it? We're all about local food. Generally can't legally sell the game meat they harvest to a restaurant or a butcher shop. There are very few.
Iwana in Toronto. His restaurant, Ku Kim Kitchen, focuses on indigenous ingredients, but he has to use farmed elk or...
Legally buy wild game? He's actually challenging those laws. His argument is, look, legalizing this wouldn't just mean more authentic food. It would create a vital help rebuild a sustainable economy.
And it's not just market rules. Land use policy itself can be a barrier. You mentioned national parks earlier.
Yeah, that's a tough one. We tend ecologically, but the sources show their creation often directly harmed indigenous food sovereignty. Banff is a key example. The Stony Nakota and other groups, they're subsistence hunting and gathering, specifically to protect the area for wealthy tourists coming for sport hunting and fishing.
So recreational use was prioritized over basic subsistence.
Consciously prioritized. Hunting is still illegal in about half of Canada's national parks, even for Indigenous peoples with treaty rights in some cases. It's complex, but the barrier is real.
The economic hits have also come from international policy, right? Thinking about the Inuit seal hunt.
Oh, absolutely devastating. The Inuit food system around the seal is so integrated. It's not just food. Seal provides protein, yes, for clothing, and historically, pelts for trade commerce. It's an entire economy vertically integrated.
And the big blow came with that EU ban on seal products.
In 2009, yeah, the European Union banned imports. This was pushed hard by animal rights and environmental groups like Greenpeace, who, to their credit, later distinguished between the large commercial hunt, which they opposed, and the traditional, sustainable Inuit subsistence hunt.
But the damage was done.
Instantly. The price for seal pelts just collapsed. Dropped from maybe $105 down to $15 practically overnight. That wiped out a crucial source they needed for gas, for snowmobiles, for rifles, for gear, everything you need to hunt, even just to feed your family.
So even subsistence hunting became harder to afford.
Much harder. Look at the Muskrat Falls Hydroelectric Dam project in Labrador right now. There's huge concern among Inuit communities downstream. They fear the dam will release from flooded land into the river system,
contaminating the fish and seals they rely on.
Exactly. Charlotte Wolfrey, she's the Ungajukuk, or mayor, of Rigolet. It's about more than just diet.
What did she say?
That if the seals become contaminated, people will just stop eating them, and then the knowledge transfer stops. She said once people stop eating seal, they won't be teaching their children to eat seal. Eating seal. That's what I'm most afraid of. Seal is part of what makes us who we are.
Wow. Losing your culture because the food source is poisoned.
That's profound.
But, okay, despite all these massive challenges, historical, legal, environmental, incredible resilience, communities are fighting back. Reclaiming their food systems.
Absolutely. There are some really powerful stories of resurgence, of resistance, and clever adaptation. Take Eel Ground First Nation, for example. They're Natowaganag Community Food Center.
Okay.
But they hit a practical snag. Some community members, maybe more used to processed foods, found the moose meat too gamey in flavor.
Ah, interesting challenge. So what do they do? Give up?
No way. They got creative. They turned their community kitchen into like a test kitchen for traditional food.
Yeah.
They experimented with mousse and apple juice, mellowed the flavor just enough people loved it. Yeah. So then they could gradually substitute that high quality traditions like, say, hot dogs in their food programs. It's about meeting people where they are, you know, and gently guiding things back towards healthier traditional options.
The change is happening on the land itself.
Community Forest Corporation out in BC, they managed to get a 25-year tenure agreement over their traditional territory, and that allowed them to completely flip the script on how that land is managed.
How so?
Instead of just focusing on resource extraction, like how much timber can we cut, restoration. That meant things like actually removing some of the pine trees they'd previously planted as monoculture. to encourage the natural vegetation that moose prefer, leaving fallen trees to boost biodiversity.
So managing for ecological health and traditional use, not just profit.
Exactly. And the results, tangible. Moose and deer are physically returning to the area. It shows that, you know, economics can go hand in hand, especially when indigenous perspectives lead the way.
We also see examples like the Rainy River First Nations working to bring back sturgeon populations. But in the north, with Inuit communities, a lot of the fight seems to be around challenging the stigma against Inuit.
Yes, that's a huge piece, challenging institutional barriers and perceptions. And this is where you see some really bold, assertive actions. The story of the seal sharing at the Art Gallery of Ontario, the AOZIL in Toronto, it's just incredible.
Tell us about that. What happened?
Okay, and the Inuit co-curators made a request. They asked to butcher and share a whole seal traditionally, respectfully, right there in Walker Court, the AGO's main big public space.
Wow, in the middle of the art gallery.
Right on the floor. It wasn't just a demo. The sources describe it as deeply spiritual, but it was also profoundly political. An assertion of sovereignty, of cultural practice, right inside a major Canadian cultural institution. Hundreds of seal meat.
What was the reaction? From the city, the institution.
This is the amazing part. Afterwards, the city of Toronto actually sent the AGO a thank you letter. They said the event helped them learn about Inuit food practices and how to make the city more welcoming. A municipal understanding around cultural food safety.
That's incredible impact.
Isn't it? And you see similar wins on a community level, too. Like the Tumulu, they basically had to fight government regulations that said only store-bought food was safe for kids. They argued, no, food straight from a hunter is the freshest, safest, cleanest food there is.
And they won.
They won. They proved their point. And now, because of their fight, all daycares in Iqaluit are allowed to serve Inuksuitut every day. It's normalizing tradition.
These efforts, the hunting, the restoration, the advocacy, which brings us to this idea of new economic models emerging. You mentioned the Nadiskwit program.
Right, Nadiskwit. It means Inuit stewards or guardians. This program in the Kikakolik region of Nunavut establishes fully paid, full-time jobs for environmental stewards and providers.
Paid full-time jobs as hunters. How is that funded?
This is key. It's supported by funding from IVA's impact and benefit agreements. These are agreements negotiated between indigenous communities and resource extraction companies, like mines operating on their lands. Community.
Ah, so the money generated from resource extraction, which can sometimes cause the environmental problems.
Gets channeled directly back into funding stewardship, traditional skills, and food provision by the people who know the land best. It tackles both the huge cost barrier to hunting we talked about earlier to pass on knowledge.
So it professionalizes hunting and stewardship again.
Exactly. It makes it a viable, respected career path again. It supports experienced hunters and allows them to train younger people. It directly builds food sovereignty and cultural continuity.
Okay, so putting this all together, crisis, but also this powerful resurgence. What's the big takeaway here? What's the fundamental shift needed for reconciliation around food?
I think it's realizing the core problem isn't just that store-bought food is too expensive and is restoring the land's ability to feed people like it always did. Joseph LeBlanc puts it starkly. Real transformation means challenging what he calls the unassailable prioritization of resource extraction.
Meaning we have to stop seeing land only for its timber or minerals.
Precisely. And instead, actively integrate indigenous worldviews and knowledge into how we manage. The government needs to value the land for more than just what can be taken out of it.
And the sources really push back against that passive idea that, oh, well, it's just too late to save what's been lost.
Yeah. LeBlanc calls that idea itself a colonial tool, a way to justify not changing. He says, look around. People who are living a traditional lifestyle today, deeply connected to the land and traditional food, they are often the happiest.
Which leads to a pretty challenging final thought, especially for policymakers and maybe for all of us listening.
It does. LeBlanc poses this question, essentially. If our legislators, our decision makers, are products of an education system that has historically conditioned them to see Indigenous peoples in a particular light, often.
Then how deep does the re-education need to go?
Exactly. How fundamental must that shift in understanding be before Canada about land? And if you can't have a truthful conversation about land, how can you possibly create effective just food policy?
That education piece feels foundational. The prerequisite for any real justice or change, that's a really powerful place to leave it for today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. It's been sobering, but also hopeful. We'll be back soon with more insights.
On September 23rd and 24th, you can meet over 100 employers in the main gym of the Athletics and Recreation Center. If you are considered technology fields, then join us on September 23rd for the Engineering 24th. Many top companies, organizations, and schools will be at the Career and Further Education Fair. Pick up your free copy of Queen's Highlights magazine on both days and get free professional headshots on Thursday, September 24th. Both events are open to all Queen's students of all years and run from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Huntington's is a degenerative disease of the brain.
If you took schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and you mix them all together, you would have Huntington's disease.
Learn more at huntingtonsociety.ca.
Somebody from outside the government person said, if you don't say a word, I'm going to help you. That's why I went to school. They had no choice. Kids that went to school, and I used to cry, I was lonesome. I was wondering why I was sent here. And I didn't know why.
Does it feel like we're on the edge? Certain day, why does it feel like the story ends before it starts? We were here in these fading memories, so we were here in these fleeting stories, oh, we were here in these, even when they start. It's in our blood. It's in our blood. Oh, oh, oh. It's in our blood. It's in our blood. I guess we come and we go just like the days is light and dark and the morning rays. I guess you know all we meant, we fade away. A month, a day, a week, a year, just like to say that we were here. We were here, fading memories, so we were here. And we speak in stories, so we were here. In words, even when they start.
Kagis pinatamas of pamatsuin, we went sa sin, maga, we ay man.
Ananais, man, 10:05 o'clock, 13:13, ako na siya si Dad, managtigibat, ako matwinak tumakamilin. Impose your name on my phone.
my mama's bed.
Hey, and they, yo, oh, hey.